Good morning, this is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. I'm podcasting today from the coast of California, and I'm joined today by my colleague and partner in Pituitary World News, Mr. Jorge Facinetti. Jorge, welcome.
Great to be here and ready for another discussion with what I'm sure will be amazing insight for our listeners. Why don't you tell us what's on your mind for today's podcast?
So we at Pituitary World News receive through our website, but also on our Facebook pages, requests to discuss varied topics. And today, Jorge, I wanted to discuss a topic that you raised, and that's about aggressive pituitary tumors, and in particular invasive pituitary tumors. And I wonder if you would share with our audience why you felt this might be a relevant topic.
Well, yes, this is a subject that, as you know, is very dear and near to me. My pituitary tumor was quite large and invasive. And as you know, it had invaded the cavernous sinus and was quite close to the ICA, the anterior carotid artery, and the ocular nerve. Thankfully, my tumor was benign, although I know there's probably no such thing as a benign tumor. They all create some kind of havoc in one system. So I vividly remember you and Dr. Kunwar telling me at the pre-op meeting that the most likely you would not be able to remove it all. But thankfully, most of it was removed, although I think 5% of the original tumor remains. And it's being managed very nicely with medications. So, but given this personal experience, I'm really curious why some tumors are invasive and some are not. So maybe we can start our discussion with this.
Jorge, it's a very interesting point. Good question. Great topic to discuss today. I actually authored a paper on this subject probably, 20 years ago, and thought I had a pretty good understanding about what aggressive pituitary tumors were at the time, but to have learned a lot since then through caring for a wide variety of patients with what I would deem to be aggressive pituitary adenomas. There are a lot of approaches to the nomenclature of pituitary adenomas. The World Health Organization classifies pituitary adenomas as either benign or malignant. But I will tell you, some of the benign ones seem fairly malignant to me, even though they don't meet the official criteria for being a malignant lesion.
So what defines a pituitary malignancy?
A pituitary lesion is deemed to be malignant if it spreads to another part of the body. And the most common pathways of spread of pituitary adenomas is that they will fall down and drop into the lymph nodes in the neck if they're malignant. They can also spread to other parts of the brain through the spinal fluid or spread to distant organs such as the liver. Occasionally, however, a pituitary lesion is deemed to be malignant because it seeds the operative site. So, for example, a patient might have a transcranial operation to resect a pituitary tumor, and then they have a metastasis at the site where the skull was entered. Or a patient might have a recurrence of a lesion known as a metastasis or a drop metastasis at the area of the transphenoidal surgery, totally separate from where the original lesion was. And sometimes that's how we figure out these things are malignant. In fact, most malignancies reported in the literature have been diagnosed after death at the time of autopsy. And the patients died from some other reason, but during autopsy were found to have pituitary tumor in their liver, in their spinal column, for example, and they had a history of a pituitary tumor that was invasive during life. So that means that some patients who do have invasive or aggressive pituitary tumors during life probably do have malignancies, and we don't identify that during life. It certainly would be nice to have a way to figure those patients out so that we can be able to more aggressively treat during life when the patient is presenting with a pituitary tumor and the multiple complications thereof. And there are some ways to do that that we'll talk about a little later.
So if most pituitary tumors are benign and the malignant ones are rare, I believe you told me that in your medical career, you've seen about 20 documented cases of pituitary malignancy. So what you mostly see are benign, but I imagine you've seen a lot of aggressive and invasive pituitary adenomas. So what is an aggressive pituitary tumor? What makes it aggressive?
Well, pituitary tumors can be aggressive in several different ways. Firstly, they can cause severe hormone perturbations, whether it be tremendous acromegaly or Cushing's or severe hyperthyroidism. And those manifestations of the disorders often, in many cases, rival the manifestations that a malignancy has on the overall human body. So they can be very aggressive, causing very high hormone levels because of very efficient cells that produce large amounts of hormones that overdrive target glands or tissues to undergo these remarkable changes that lead to severe illness in the patient. And while those aren't malignant tumors most of the time, they certainly are very aggressive hormone-secreting pituitary neoplasms.
So how about the growth pattern of the pituitary tumor? Does the way it grows speak at all to its aggressiveness?
Well, yes, indeed. Many pituitary tumors are confined to the pituitary itself or to the cella turcica, while others extend into the suprasellar cistern, and some others grow inferiorly into the sphenoid sinus and the nasal cavity. Others grow laterally into the cavernous sinuses. And in every one of these cases, the tumor either erodes or penetrates bone and the dural lining of the cella and thus crosses tissue planes. So to me, that's an aggressive tumor that has such an invasive growth pattern. In fact, if you were looking at a thyroid tumor that crossed tissue planes or a tumor in the lung that crossed tissue planes and invaded the pleura or a rib, for example, those would be considered malignancies. But in the realm of pituitary disease, we don't count those as malignancies, though a tumor anywhere else in the body that did those things would be considered to be a malignant lesion. So I have a great deal of concern about any tumor that has been invasive and believe that those patients should be watched very carefully over time for recurrences or progressive growth of any residual disease that exists after surgery.
Well, that sounds really interesting. It really also sounds like a recurrence would also be a concern. What proportion of patients have tumors that recur after surgery?
Well, that's a good question, Jorge. It depends on the skill and expertise of the surgeon. But in general, of those patients who achieve a gross total resection of their tumor, regardless of who the surgeon was, the literature will state that anywhere between 12 and 18% of patients with macroadenomas will experience a recurrent disease at some point.
Well, does that then imply that these tumors that recur are an aggressive variety of a pituitary adenoma?
Well, that's a great question, and to some extent, yes, but not always. Some of these are relatively benign, banal, slow-growing tumors that don't really cause much trouble, but just enough of the cells survived the initial operation to then continue to grow new blood vessels and divide and form another tumor deposit. Whenever we see a recurrent pituitary tumor, it usually implies that some residual disease was left behind at surgery. Might have been microscopic, not visible to the surgeon at the time, but it does increase in size over time and looks like a recurrent tumor. But in that setting, the patient generally was not cured the first time around.
So how could that happen? How could a surgeon believe that she or he gets all the tumor out, but yet the patient can have a recurrence because there is a residual disease?
Studies have showed that, and it ranges depending on tumor subtype, but a surprising number of these tumors actually have microinvasion of the pituitary and of the dural lining of the cella, so that when you think you have all the tumor, you actually have little fingers, if you will, or rootlets of these tumors that grow into surrounding normal tissues, and they can be left behind when the bulk of the tumor is removed. In fact, when you look at the number of patients who actually do have that microinvasion, it's shocking that the recurrence rate's not any higher than it is. And one of my hypotheses is that the cells that remain have their blood supply cut off so that they die afterwards, and therefore the recurrence rate is not nearly as high as we would expect based on the documented cases of microinvasion that have been proved by several investigators who have actually gone in and biopsied the hole or the normal tissue in surrounding the hole where the tumor was at the time of surgery. I will say, however, that those tumors that are multiply recurrent and require multiple therapeutic modalities are ones that I do consider to be with a propensity for growth and more aggressive and more likely to cause trouble for patients. I think that most pituitary operations I've ever seen a patient require for pituitary tumor is 6. That patient also had 2 courses of radiotherapy as well. So some of these tumors can be dastardly and difficult to manage and are aggressive, though not meeting the criteria for malignancy. However, in some of these patients where I've seen multiple surgical procedures required, I'd have to argue that their tumors are behaving in a malignant fashion.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that there may be some ways to tell more about the characteristics of tumors and predict who might have an aggressive lesion. Tell us more about that.
There are a few techniques or tools that the pathologist can use to help us understand more about these pituitary lesions that are removed when they evaluate the tissue in the pathology department. For example, they can look at the cell type. We see patients with non-functioning tumors, for example, that when they do immunochemistry to determine what hormones are produced but not necessarily secreted by those tumors, we can identify silent ACTH-producing tumors, for example, or silent growth hormone-producing tumors. And we know that the silent ACTH-producing tumors are a little more aggressive than the regular non-functioning tumors. Also, some patients with acromegaly that's generally mild and also mild coexisting hyperprolactinemia have what's called an acidophil stem cell adenoma, and that is a more aggressive lesion than your more differentiated, better behaving, pure growth hormone secreting pituitary adenoma. The acidophil stem cell is the stem cell that then turns into growth hormone producing cells and prolactin cells. So if you have a tumor composed of those more primitive cells, they're more aggressive. The regulation over the control and division and other aspects of the cell cycle is not as great, so those tumors are more likely to grow more quickly. So immunochemistry to detect hormone production but not secretion in non-functioning tumors can be useful to identify those non-functioning tumors that might be more aggressive. Another immunochemical technique is what's called the MIB-1 study, which is an antibody against the Ki-67 protein. And this is a protein that's expressed in cells when they're in the process of dividing, getting ready to divide, or having recently divided, and it gives us what's called a proliferative index. Most benign pituitary tumors, a very small proportion of the cells are dividing, maybe up to 2%. In malignant pituitary lesions, it's a great percentage of cells that are dividing, probably upwards of 12 to 15% or more. The highest I've seen was about 65%. And then in the invasive tumors, their MIB-1 labeling index is sort of intermediate grade between the pure benign tumors and also the tumors that are overtly malignant. So we can get an idea based on the proportion of cells that are dividing whether they're more likely to be benign or malignant tumors. The problem is that I have seen plenty of benign tumors that have invaded tissues and grown aggressively, have very low MIB-1 labeling indices, and this could be a tissue sampling, that you're sampling part of the tumor that's not actively growing, because I firmly believe that the population of cells throughout the tumor is heterogeneous, and you may have one part of the tumor that's more likely to grow faster than another part of the tumor, and it just depends on what's sampled at the time of surgery as to what that MIB-1 labeling index is going to show. And we're in the process of starting to plan some studies to see if there's any validity to this theory that sometimes we see aggressive tumors with low indices because we haven't appropriately sampled enough of the tumor. The other thing that we can do is immunochemistry for the P53 antigen. And this is a protein that's usually expressed in cancers, and it can be expressed in the more aggressive pituitary lesions as well. So we have these immunochemical techniques, and I think it's leading to the reclassification of pituitary tumors that have low MIB1 labeling indices and no P53 staining as benign. Those that have high MIB1 labeling indices and high P53 staining as malignant, and those that have intermediate values or one or the other that's high are going to probably in the future, we certainly use it now in our center, defined as atypical pituitary adenomas, and it's sort of a tumor that sits on the fence between benign and malignant, probably more aggressive, may undergo malignant transformation, may recur more readily and be in need of additional treatment.
Wow, that's really remarkable and tremendous that you can offer the patient a classification of their tumor based on what you find at surgery. Have you seen any surprises, things you didn't expect to see?
Jorge, that's a very insightful question. In fact, I have seen surprises. Recently, I had a patient who had a small prolactinoma who didn't respond very well to dopamine agonist drugs and decided that she wanted to have surgery so she could plan a family in the future and didn't want to go through pregnancy with a pituitary adenoma. And she went to surgery at her request, and her tumor turned out to be an atypical prolactinoma with a very high P53 labeling index, which actually raised my eyebrows and made me think that this lady might have had a pituitary cancer that we just caught at a very early stage. Now, fortunately, she appears to be rendered disease-free. And I had the same thing with a recent patient with acromegaly who had hyperprolactinemia and mild acromegaly with mild elevations in IGF-1 and a small tumor, maybe 9 millimeters, and she went to surgery and had pretty remarkable P53 and MIB1 labeling indices to where I was concerned about that. So I was very happy that she went to surgery and that we were able to render her disease-free as well. So, yeah, there are surprises, but there are equal number of surprises the opposite direction where we see an aggressive lesion. And, again, these immunochemical techniques that are done in the laboratory aren't in keeping with what we observe clinically. So I think then that a classification scheme has to take into account not only what the pathologist can tell us, but what we see on the MRI and what we see over time. The bottom line is that patients with pituitary adenomas require long-term, probably lifelong follow-up, periodic MRI studies, and regular office visits.
So as a patient, certainly for some patients, staying connected with your condition, with your own condition, is really critical. How often should people with pituitary adenomas, and particularly large tumors and aggressive tumors, have MRI studies performed?
That's a very good question. Generally, for patients who have hormone-secreting tumors, after they've had an MRI 1 year from surgery, I typically recommend MRI studies only if they have biochemical evidence of disease recurrence. So really the question applies mostly to those patients who have non-functioning tumors. I used to tell patients once a year for 3 to 5 years, and you can go every 2 years, and then if you're clear after 5 to 10 years, not again unless you have symptoms. But it's remarkable the number of people that I have seen who have a recurrent tumor after 5 years of follow-up in an interval of not having had an MRI in 3 to 5 years. So I don't know what the good answer is. I think it's a gestalt and an impression that the physician and perhaps also the patient will develop based on all the data available about the size of the tumor, invasiveness, whether hormones are secreted, but also sort of patient preference and patient-directed self-care, as long as it's reasonable and in keeping with general approaches to medicine. We should probably do MRIs whenever we feel it to be necessary on any of the factors that are involved in the status of the tumor and the overall health and desires and wishes of the patient.
Well, Dr. Blevins, this has certainly been very informative. Thank you for this information. On a personal note, I'm always struck by how so many things that perceptively you'd think of it as, you know, black and white or benign and malignant have so much gray area in them, and how much of that requires a knowledge and experience to manage it and to understand it. It really has been great talking about these aggressive pituitary tumors and really insightful. I'm sure our audience will find it, will find the information quite useful and very informative. So to our audience, if you have any comments or questions and you'd like to drop us a line, please do so by going to pituitaryworldnews.com and click on the contact page, or send us an email at info@pituitaryworldnews.com, and we'll be happy to respond. So thank you again, and look forward to the next one.
Jorge, it's my pleasure. It's been a fantastic discussion, great set of questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this forum with you to share news about pituitary disorders with those out there who are affected, their families, friends, colleagues, and their physicians and other healthcare providers. Have a wonderful day.